Well, there are still a few people coming, but I think it's time to go ahead and get started. So once again, a warm welcome to everyone who has joined us for this awesome defense of our thesis that Ellen Price will be giving in the coming 45 to 50 minutes or so. Of course, doing this remotely is not as much fun as doing it in person. But it does have the silver lining that people can call in from further away. So a special welcome to those of you who are calling in from not Cambridge. Of course, the people in Cambridge were super happy to see you too. Also a special thank you to Ellen's committee who's here. So we have Sean Andrews, David Wilner, Dimitar Sasselhoff, who are here locally. And then Ralph Pudritz is our special external examiner. But then we actually have two more external members that I'll be talking a little bit more about in a moment. But Ilse Cleaves and Leslie Rogers, welcome as well. Ellen first approached me to do her thesis with me, I guess not a little bit more than 5 years ago. And I must say that at first I felt a little bit of trepidation because, as you will find out, Ellen is very much a theorist, and I am very much not. I had some qualms, whether I could give Ellen the advice that you're supposed to give as an advisor for her thesis. There were two things that pushed me over the edge to say yes. One was the obvious talent on Ellen's part. And I guess as an outgrowth of that, my realization of that together with Ellen, we could do things that I just could never have done on myself or with anyone else that I was working with. And that was too much of a temptation, those two things together to say no to. And as you'll see, I am very happy that I said yes, and I think you will understand that in the next few minutes as you see Ellen's work. But Ellen then did a very clever thing, which is that she did realize that I was not the theorist, and therefore assembled sort of advising team rather than relying only on me, and her effective co-advisors. Professor Ilse Cleaves at the University of Virginia and Professor Leslie Rogers at the University of Chicago are both here and both part of Ellen's committee. So I just fully want to acknowledge that this was really, an advising team effort that has helped us get here today. So Ellen's thesis is really on the development of different kinds of numerical methods. To address to me really fascinating problems in what the chemical environment is like where planets and planetesimals assemble, as well as what the structure of really bizarre planets are like that then form in these disks and that we can detect in different ways. Ellen loves developing these kind of methods. So I'm going to paraphrase a conversation that we had at some point since I unfortunately didn't take notes at the time, but it went something like this to illustrate this characteristic. So we're having our usual meeting, and Ellen is trying to figure out some theoretical problem that I still haven't really fully understood what it was. And she tells me that she thinks she has found the method that she needs to solve this problem. And I'm like, that's exciting, but why think? Like, what's the issue? Why don't you know yet that this is the right solution? And then Ellen answers back, well, the article I found is in Russian, and I don't speak Russian, so I still need to figure out if it's actually applicable. But equations are equations, so I think I can figure it out. And she did, and this ended up being part, I think now what she wants to do, not necessarily did as part of her thesis applying this weird method, but what she wants to continue to do as a postdoc. But it's just one of many, I guess, meetings during the past few years where I have been pushed well out of my comfort zone into theory land by Ellen. And I'm just so grateful to have been part of this journey together and to really be made uncomfortable, especially when we consider, I think, the really cool results that has come out of it. So, you know, thank you, Ellen, for continuously pushing my horizons and understanding in the past few years. And I can say with some certainty that there's no way I would have entered this deep into theory land without you. And it's been, you know, it's been lots of fun to do that together. But without any further stories or embarrassment, I do want to hand it over to Ellen to tell us something about her work that she has been pursuing in the past few years. So Ellen, the floor is yours.
So Karin, can you just give me a thumbs up if you see my slide and only my slide? Okay, great. All right. So, thank you for the lovely introduction, Karin. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for logging in from various time zones. I really do appreciate your support today. Welcome to my dissertation colloquium. And as Karin mentioned, today I'll be telling you about my research for the last 6 years. And if we have time, but definitely in the private defense, I can talk a little bit about where I'll be going from here. But first, there are, of course, as is tradition, a few people that I'd like to thank, and I'm going to try not to cry when I do it. So first, I'd like to thank my family. They have encouraged me and supported me emotionally and financially until I was able to support myself. My parents paid for me to attend Caltech, which was really challenging for me, but it helped make me more competitive as a grad school candidate, so I really appreciate that. And even before that, you know, my parents really enabled me, helping me go to a really good high school, helping me do all the extracurricular things that I wanted to do that made me, a competitive candidate to get into Caltech. So they've really been pushing my career forward this whole time. Next, I'd like to thank my fellow graduate students and naming everyone who has let me invade their offices to talk about my latest math problem, which is something I do pretty frequently, would take more time than I really have today. So I've just opted to list a few particularly close colleagues who've been especially helpful over the last 6 years. Thank you for letting me bombard you with confusing math and allowing me to fix your various computer problems. I actually have a little short thing to say to each of you over on this slide, so I hope you're here. So Jamila, you have been my writing partner for basically a year now since the pandemic started. It's been great talking to you every day about my latest plot or the latest code bug that I fixed, and thanks for letting me talk your ear off sometimes too. Locke, you're a wonderful human being and you brighten up my day every time we see each other. Thank you for celebrating with me and never making me feel like I had to hide who I really am. Roxana, you're an amazing office mate, and I miss seeing you there every day. I hope we can enjoy a reunion before we proceed to our respective next jobs. Jane, I always looked up to you in group meeting and wondered how you knew so many awesome things, especially about bugs in CASA, which you know so many of those. You may not have realized it then, but you were always really inspirational to me on a daily basis. Munaza, I've always admired your faith and your kindness, and I love all the walks and chats we had together, getting coffee, getting chocolate, all those times that we spent together. And finally, Theron, you've been an all-around terrific friend, a fellow gamer, an upstairs office neighbor. I miss joining you there to plan PC builds and talk about our research. There's a couple other colleagues I'd like to mention, which are Rob Schulten and Peg Herlihy. When I was sick, you made taking leave completely painless until I was ready to come back. And you've carefully maneuvered the bureaucracy at Harvard to make this a good experience for everyone involved. So thank you very much. I also have a large group of friends outside work that I'd like to thank for their support during my PhD. Some of them are here today. I'd like to thank Nick Copernicus Parker, Max DeYoung, Jacob Schenker, Cedric Fumont, Charles Sherhart, and Kelly Mauser, who make up my former study group at Caltech, also known as the physics group. I also thank Juliet Becker, Bin Yuan, Grace Tang, and Alina Huang for their continued friendship and support long after we graduated. None of this would have been possible, of course, without my various mentors going all the way back to high school. And I'd especially like to thank my first work-study mentors, Perry Jarakinis and Chrissy Ritchie, who supervised my first foray into real research. Next, John Johnson and Leslie Rogers, who advised me in undergrad and got me interested in planetary-scale astronomy. Finally, Ilse Cleves, a former CFA postdoc, and Karin Oberg, my thesis advisor, have been incredibly helpful and have taught me so much about this field. So I hope I make you all proud today. And finally, many of you are familiar with my cat, my perpetually sick cat, Callie. She's not been thrilled about all this work from home time during the pandemic, so I'd be remiss if I didn't also thank her for tolerating my presence in the apartment. And last, but certainly not least, I want to take a minute to talk about the person that I dedicated my thesis to. Rhiannon Johnson was a very dear friend of mine in high school, and she died rather suddenly after a long struggle with chronic illness. She wanted to be a medical doctor and help heal others who were sick, and I think that was based on her own experiences. I dearly wish she'd gotten that chance, but I know she's in a better place and feels no pain now. With that, I'll transition into the meat of this talk by telling you a little bit about protoplanetary disks and how I simulate them. So protoplanetary disks are disks of gas and dust that surround a young star, and they're the formation sites of planets. The gas is largely made up of molecular hydrogen and helium, but the less abundant species are also very important in the context of planet formation. On this slide, I've labeled just a couple of effects that we'll be focusing on today, accretion and grain drift, as well as dust settling. I'll talk more about those later, so don't worry. It's also important to know that stellar irradiation creates a strong temperature gradient in the disk, indicated here by a color gradient. And I've labeled the three vertical sort of zones that we typically think about in a disk. The midplane, which lies at the middle vertically, is comparatively cool and dense, and this is where all my work will focus because it's very important for planet formation. In the midplane, lots of chemical species are frozen out onto dust grains. The densities in the disk are low enough that we don't even worry about a liquid phase. Everything's either ice or gas. Even species you might not think of as traditional ices, like carbon monoxide, can be frozen out at such low temperatures. Above that, above the midplane, we have a rich molecular layer where gas phase chemistry can be important because it's warmer. And at the top is a hot ionized layer, which is bombarded by stellar and interstellar radiation and is therefore very warm. The solid component of the disk, the dust grains, are usually about 0.1 microns in size, but they grow, they fragment, they collide, bounce, settle, and drift. Not independently of the gas, but not perfectly coupled either. And I'll talk more about that in a later section. So that simple picture that I showed on the last slide really doesn't do disks justice, though, in terms of their variety. The D-Sharp survey, which observed several disks at high angular resolution, found asymmetries are actually quite common in disks. I'm showing a few of the images from the survey here where we can see some kind of weird asymmetric blob, a gap, and some kind of bright spot, another gap, and two rings. When I simulate disks, I always assume azimuthal symmetry, which is symmetry in this sort of around direction of the disk. But here we can see that that assumption could easily fail for any given disk. So why should you care about protoplanetary disks in the first place? I thought of a few reasons they might interest you, so I hope one of these applies to you. First, for the purposes of questions about origins of life, protoplanetary disk chemistry sets the composition and chemistry available to the planets that form in disks. So if you're curious about whether or not we're alone or how we got here, you might care about disks. Second, maybe you're an astronomer in another subfield, and to you, I'd say that accretion disks, which protoplanetary disks are accretion disks, also surround black holes, for example. So even if protoplanetary disks aren't your focus, the modeling efforts might still be interesting because nature loves to repeat themes. And finally, on that same thread, disks are an incredible modeling challenge, spanning many orders of magnitude in spatial and temporal scales. This is interesting in its own right, but it could also inform modeling problems in other fields or even industry. So no matter what your interest, this talk should have something for you. If you're skeptical about planet formation, let me reassure you. Astronomers have observed actively accreting protoplanets in the PDS 70 disk, which is shown here. I'm indicating the bright spots with green arrows. Those are two protoplanets. The other boxes you don't really need to worry about, but it's very encouraging that we've actually seen some forming protoplanets. And finally, there are just so many exoplanets in our galaxy. I'll talk a little more later about how they're discovered. But to date, we've confirmed 4,375 planets, with 165 of those being terrestrial planets. This sample helps put our own planet and solar system in a broader context so we can understand our place in the universe. Now, I'm going to indulge in a little thought experiment, which I hope you find illuminating because I certainly do. What if we wanted to simulate a disk perfectly? What would that take? So we'd need the equations of fluid dynamics to describe the gas component, those are the Navier-Stokes equations that you may be familiar with. We'd also need the radiative transfer equation to describe how radiation moves through the dusty material and sets its temperature. Chemistry is important. This is kind of an astrochemistry talk, so we're going to need some chemical species abundances and some chemical reactions to model. The solids in the disk, like I mentioned before, can grow and fragment, so we'll need an equation for that too. And that's before we even get into things like turbulence and stellar evolution and magnetic fields, all of which play a role too. So let's just go with these four things that I've listed here and see where we get. So we want to model all these things simultaneously. The independent variables in this simulation are pretty easy to identify. We're going to need time and space, but also frequency and angle if we're going to do radiation. That gives us six independent variables. For the dependent variables, there are just so many of them. In addition to the fluid's density, momentum, and energy, and the radiation intensity, we need to track every chemical abundance, of which there could be hundreds or even thousands, depending on your ambition, and as many grain size bins as possible to simulate a continuous distribution of sizes. I should mention that computers and distributions are just a little bit difficult, so we're going to break our distribution into bins and call it a day. So let's say we've written down some giant partial differential equation and all those variables. It's well posed and we have boundary conditions and we're ready to march through time. How much computer memory would we spend storing a single snapshot of this disk? Assuming a spatial grid in three dimensions with 100 subdivisions in each direction and 1,000 dependent variables to track, noting that neither of those are nearly enough like we sort of covered on the previous slide, the state vector of this disk is going to be 8 gigabytes, which is about the total amount of memory on your standard laptop computer. If we need some operator, a matrix, that tells us how to get from one snapshot to the next, that's going to be 8 exabytes in size, if we store it densely. For the uninitiated, that is just unimaginably large, but Wolfram Alpha does estimate that 1 exabyte is about the information content of all the words ever spoken. So how do we actually simulate disks? The point I want to convey is that the approach in this thought experiment isn't the right way. In reality, we make various approximations, we exploit symmetries, eliminate unimportant variables, and solve simplified versions of the full system to make forward progress. And I hope you'll see today that that's exactly what I've done. I solve sort of simplified systems to understand one effect and then move on. In this talk, I'm going to discuss four separate projects, and here are some key ideas I hope you'll take away. In the first section, I'll try to convince you that accretion is an important effect that can change the results of modeling a protoplanetary disk. Next, I'll show you that grain drift provides a simple and robust explanation for enhanced cometary carbon monoxide. Then, I'll switch gears and tell you about how the Roche limit can help us constrain exoplanetary compositions. And finally, I'll demonstrate that the shape of an exoplanetary transit changes in a predictable way when the planet is distorted away from a spherical shape. Without further ado, let's get started with my first project, which focuses on the process of accretion in protoplanetary disks. The motivation for this project came when I noticed that lots of disk models will simulate either chemistry or dynamics, but rarely both. I wondered how this might change things, and Karin suggested working with Ilse to implement accretion in an existing disk model. But I actually ended up redeveloping that model from scratch because I just can't work with Fortran code. But it was a great learning experience, and I hope I can impress upon you the number of moving parts involved in this model. So I've mentioned accretion a few times, but I haven't told you what it is. An accreting disk is one where material is falling onto the central star. In the disk I'll be modeling in this section, viscous evolution is important too. Viscous evolution is a diffusion process, and it moves material both inwards toward the star, where it accretes onto the star, and outwards away from the star. You can sort of think of diffusion as like a spreading out process. To illustrate this, I've put together this short animation. Instead of the disk's usual profile, we'll start with a thin ring of material, which you see in yellow here. The velocity field of the disk is shown in the colored streaks. I've also put in three test points, which you'll see in the green, orange, and red colors. I'm going to sample the temperature, the surface density, and the velocity of the material at the test points. For this illustration, it's useful to see what happens to material that starts inside the ring, on the ring, and outside the ring, which is why I chose those three locations. You can watch these gauges on the left side, on the right side, to see how the fields change. I've colored each needle to correspond to a test point. So let's see what happens as time moves forward. So if we pause here for just a second, you can see that the disk material quickly lost its ring structure and is spreading out in space. I should mention that all these frames are taken at equally spaced time points. So you'll see that the first sample is a rather dramatic change, but the others are pretty subtle. So it's spreading out, it's lost its ring structure. That's the diffusion I mentioned before. So let's keep going. Let's pause again. You can hopefully tell that the green test point is getting closer to the star, which is not shown, but it's at the center of the disk. The orange dot has stayed at roughly the same radial position, while the red dot is moving outward. When I finish the animation, the green dot will almost have accreted onto the central star, but the red dot will have disappeared from the image. This is the final frame of the animation, and as you've seen, the temperature has increased for the green point and decreased for the others, because the green point is getting closer to the star. The density just decreases, since the material is spreading out and getting thinner. Another thing you should take away from this animation is that the three points, which originated very close together, never crossed paths. And that's very important for how we're going to simulate the accretion disk. So when we think about simulating a disk, we might imagine doing a global simulation, kind of like what I presented in the thought experiment at the beginning of the talk. We already established that those are very expensive and probably not practical. Another two options are reducing the chemical network or the physics to help simplify things, but it's difficult to know at the beginning what might be safe to exclude. We haven't simulated anything yet, so how do we really know? So instead, we choose to do a local simulation. And that means that we track the physics and chemistry along a trajectory, much like the trajectories of the points in the animation, and then sample a few trajectories to learn what's going on in the disk overall. This only works because the trajectories, or accretion streams, don't interact with each other. We'll break that assumption in a later project. Now, I mentioned radiative transfer at the beginning of this talk, but I didn't say much about it. So let's dive a little deeper into this topic with the goal of understanding why the protoplanetary disk's temperature is really hard to determine. So let's suppose we have a star surrounded by some dusty clouds. I've drawn them as separated clouds here, but in reality, the material should be sort of continuous. This is a cartoon of sort of a disk that's a little clumpy. The star radiates, which heats each cloud. So you'll see their colors change as they are heating up. Orange is sort of hotter than blue, is hotter than purple. You get the idea. The clouds absorb and scatter radiation according to their absorption and scattering coefficients. But the clouds also re-radiate at a temperature lower than the stars. At the end, it's very difficult to say exactly what the temperature of each cloud should be because of their mutual influence on each other. I say it's difficult, but it's not impossible. And that's where the radiative transfer equation comes in. This is the radiative transfer equation. It encodes how the radiation intensity changes with time, space, angle, and frequency. The details of the equation are not super important for the purposes of this talk, but I just want to communicate how difficult this equation is to solve. Hidden in the symbols B and J are the temperature of the dust and the integral of the radiation field over angle, making this an integrodifferential equation. These are just notoriously difficult to deal with. There isn't a really good numerical method for them that I have ever heard. Furthermore, the temperature is set by the radiation field, like we discussed on the previous slide, so now we have a dependency loop. We decided to use an iterative procedure and a code called RadmC3D to find the equilibrium solution to this equation rather than solving it directly. RadmC3D is a Monte Carlo code. For radiative transfer, that means that it simulates a random set of photon packets drawn from the blackbody distribution of the star and propagates them through the material. After thousands or even millions of photons, the temperature will begin to converge, and that's all we really need for the disk simulation. We don't need the full radiation field. So this is how the full temperature iteration method proceeds. We begin with a temperature guess, like a power law with a negative index, which means that the temperature falls off as we move further from the star. Next, we run a code that solves for the evolution of the surface density of the disk using the classical Lindenbell and Pringle formulation for an accretion disk. Then we run RadmC3D to get the temperature. As I mentioned before, a Monte Carlo code is inherently random, so there's going to be some numerical noise in the temperatures. Instead of using that data directly, we developed a flexible function that captures the overall behavior of the temperature in time and space. At the end of the iteration, we check to see if the new temperatures match the last iteration's temperatures. When they do, we're done. But if they don't, we loop, saving the last set of temperatures for the next iteration. This surprisingly actually converges pretty rapidly, and it gives us an analytic form for the temperature, which is really useful when we need to, say, take a derivative of the temperature, which is something that we will need to do. So here, I'm just summarizing the local simulation method once the temperature structure is set. We solve for the surface density without any chemistry as a function of space and time. Note that the chemistry doesn't feed back on the surface density, which is why we can do this. Then we choose a few radial positions to start the parcel trajectories, just like the test particles in the animation. We find that the innermost tracks tend to be the most scientifically interesting, but we simulated a few others too. Finally, we trace the trajectories through the disk, storing the abundances of all 644 chemical species at each time step, with rates computed from the local conditions in the disk, like temperature and surface density, volume density. But it's important to remember that the chemistry is almost surely going to depend on the history of the parcel, as well as on its current environment. And that's exactly what we found in our results. Movement through the disk tends to enable different chemistry than if we held the parcel at some fixed location. So what do these accretion tracks actually look like? Here, I'm showing the radial positions of a few accretion streams with time, as well as some other fields. But I'm pointing to what I would consider to be the most scientifically interesting track, which is in this dark blue. We found that cosmic rays play a very important role in driving chemistry for our innermost track. While the rate is pretty much constant for the other three tracks, the innermost one sees a factor of about 100 reduction in the cosmic ray rate over its lifetime. That happens because the increasing surface density of the disk will block more and more of the cosmic rays impinging on the disk. The innermost track also sees a dramatic increase in its local temperature, both because it's approaching the star and because of the effects of stellar evolution. Now I'd like to give you an idea of what we found, and before I just throw a giant plot up on the screen, I'm going to show you just a single panel to give you a flavor of it. Each bubble on this plot represents a chemical species in the disk model. I've labeled a few, but you'll see that you'll see in a minute that they've been colored by the heaviest atom in the molecule. So orange, for example, corresponds to carbon, and the blue ring actually refers to the fact that it's a hydrocarbon, which could have been scientifically interesting. Species that fall along the gray dashed line didn't see an appreciable change in their abundance in the dynamic disk model, where we follow the trajectory, versus a static disk model where we hold the packets fixed in space. You can see that water and carbon monoxide fall into this group where they're very abundant, but they see very little change, depending on the movement of the parcel. But for somewhat less abundant species, we start to see pretty wild variations around the line, meaning enhancement above the line or depletion below the line. You'll see actually formaldehyde sort of down at the bottom. is particularly depleted in this particular panel. As you move further to the left of the plot, the sort of variations around the line aren't as scientifically important because the species aren't as abundant. So an enhancement or depletion isn't as significant for something that wasn't very abundant anyway, unless it's several orders of magnitude. But you can see that there are a few of those too. So what does all this mean? This indicates that accretion is an important process to simulate, but we can't predict from the beginning what the effects of adding accretion in a particular model will be. Now, when I put this plot into context, you'll see that there isn't a clear trend among all these four panels with the color, with the species. It really seems pretty random. And of course, it's not random. It's based on a simulation. But all I really want to tell you is that accretion does turn out to be very important for the simulation. We just can't predict at the beginning what species will be enhanced, which ones will be depleted, which ones see no change. So, you know, if you're a modeler, take accretion into account. Now let's move on to the next project, where we'll have to take a very different modeling approach. This project also results in a more testable hypothesis about the prevalence of carbon monoxide enhanced comets, but we'll get to that in a minute. So the idea for this work, I can't take credit for it really, it was Ilse's idea, comes from the fact that we have just a few observations of comets where the carbon monoxide to water ratio is particularly high. So here I'm just pointing with an arrow to the carbon monoxide bar on this plot. Comets usually have a pretty low carbon monoxide abundance, as is shown in this bar graph. You'll notice that this plot is on a log scale, so the carbon monoxide is going to be around 1% relative abundance to water, with a maximum observation of a little over 10%. And yet we have this small population of comets, where the CO abundance is much higher than that. Tu-I Borisov is an interstellar comet, or a comet from another planetary system. But C2016 R2 Pan-STARRS originates here in our own solar system. We wanted to know if dust drift could explain these observations without invoking special physics or extraordinary local conditions. One of the explanations for Tu-I Borisov's unusual composition is that it could be typical of its own system. Maybe it just had more carbon monoxide. But that doesn't help us explain the other one that originates here. A much more scientifically satisfying explanation would apply to both comets. So why does dust drift at all? I've mentioned dust drift, but I haven't told you why. So dust drifts because solids don't feel a pressure force the way gases do. The solids want to orbit at Keplerian velocities, which I represent here by a green arrow. Pressure forces make the gas orbit at a slightly sub-Keplerian velocity, represented here by a blue arrow. The solids will feel a headwind from the gas, which is the difference between those velocities, represented by the orange arrow. When that happens, the solids will lose angular momentum and begin to drift towards the star radially. So I've mentioned before that we could use a local simulation for the last project because the accretion streams never cross each other. Once the dust is decoupled, even slightly from the gas, that just isn't the case anymore. So for this disk, we chose to use a reduced chemical network. So this model only contains CO and water, but it includes the full physics that we wanted to simulate. The physical model actually comes from a semi-analytic prescription for dust drift taken from Burnshall et al. 2010. So in the last project, we used an iterative method to solve for the temperature structure, like I showed you. And that was possible because we only needed to run a small subset of the simulation to get the surface density evolution. Unfortunately, that simply isn't possible for this project because we would need to run the entire simulation just to find the dust surface density, which is what matters for the temperature evolution. So we don't want to run this entire simulation multiple times. It's computationally expensive. Instead of doing that, we took a simpler approach. We were inspired by a classical paper by Chang and Goldreich, as well as the assumption that the surface density doesn't evolve too much over the disk lifetime. So we just ran the random C3D code on the initial condition and then scaled by a factor F that depends on the stellar radius and temperature. As the young star evolves, it contracts and becomes hotter, changing the factor F with time. I'm showing a plot of the two regimes we found in the isochrones used to compute F, and an interpolation between them that just smooths things out over time. So here I'm again showing just one panel of a bigger plot to give you a flavor of what's involved in the modeling. We need to track the surface density of gas just like before, and that's what I'm showing here for our fiducial or sort of normal disk model. You can see that the surface density falls off rapidly at large radii like it should. The different colors are showing you snapshots at different times, up to 1 million years in the lightest color. But when we put this plot in context, you can see that the interesting features develop in the surface densities of the small dust and larger pebbles, the two solid sizes that we considered, as time progresses. This has to do with how differently sized grains will drift at different speeds, according to a dimensionless number called the Stokes number. A quick check revealed that the gap-like region in the surface density opens where the Stokes number is about 1, where grains will drift the fastest. Each column of this figure corresponds to a different parameter configuration, and I'll talk about that more in a second. The rows are the different surface densities, gas at the top, pebbles in the middle, dust at the bottom. So you can see we really do need to track all of these to get a full flavor of this simulation. So finally, I'm going to show you the main result of this paper, skipping over any remaining methods. In almost every combination of parameters we tested, and we tested several, we found that it's possible to get a region of enhanced CO. In this single panel, you see the log of the CO to water ratio over space and time. That funnel-shaped purple region is where CO to water is about 1. On the side, I've integrated over space, so you can just see how the total budget evolves with time. Now putting this plot in its place, you can see that the funnel feature persists through various parameter changes. And all of these are labeled by the parameter that we changed. We experimented with the initial amount of CO, the viscosity, the drift efficiency, and the temperature. And the feature persists, except maybe in the low CO case where it's not as strong. So here's what we think is happening. Water ice-laden grains are drifting inwards at the beginning of the simulation. Meanwhile, CO is inside its snow line and sublimates off grains and back into the gas phase. The snow line is where is sort of the radial tipping point between solid and gas. So when CO is inside its snow line, it's going to sublimate into gas phase. Viscous spreading, if you remember that from earlier, carries the CO gas back across the snow line, where it's going to freeze onto whatever grains are left. So this creates a region where water is already left, but CO is just freezing out, meaning that we have enhanced CO to water. This clean and robust result shows that maybe CO-enhanced comets aren't as rare as we thought, so long as they formed at the right place and time in the disk. This paper was just accepted and should be published soon in AppJ, and in the future we hope to add grain growth and fragmentation to the model, as well as some simple chemical reactions, and more chemical species. So switching gears just a little bit, I mentioned in the beginning of this talk that there are lots of exoplanets, with the confirmed ones numbering in the thousands. But I didn't say how they're discovered, and I think it's important to have a little more context on that before diving into the next section, which will be about planets. Here I'm showing the Kepler telescope, which exceeded expectations in its primary mission before sadly losing control of too many reaction wheels. After that, the K2 mission allowed more planets to be discovered by balancing the telescope, no longer able to balance itself against solar radiation, which is just really cool. Here I'm showing the so-called Kepler orrery, which is not a video that I made. It has the attribution up at the top. Basically, this is showing the variety of different planetary systems that Kepler discovered over its lifetime. And you'll see that some of them are, you know, much smaller than our solar system. The solar system is shown with the dashed lines for reference. You'll also see that, you know, some of them have really big planets. Some of them have very small planets. It's really just really diverse. That's really all I can say about this. And that's all I want you to take away from this movie, is that Kepler discovered very diverse exoplanets not all throughout the galaxy, in the one spot that it was looking for them. So the currently active exoplanet searching telescope is TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. It is appropriately imagined here in front of a lava planet orbiting its star, because we're going to get to extreme exoplanets like that one in a few minutes. Like Kepler, it's looking for transit-like curves of exoplanets, but exoplanets are discovered through other methods like direct imaging, radio velocity surveys, and even microlensing these days. We're going to stick with the transit method for this work, though. So, we're going to switch gears, talk about planets, and we're going to specifically focus on planets that orbit very close to their stars. So you probably remember from a middle school science class that Earth has a core, a mantle, and a crust. These multiple layers mean the Earth is differentiated. And we'll assume that our exoplanets do the same and are also differentiated. For this project, we'll consider planets that have iron-rich cores, maybe larger than Earth's core, and we'll neglect upper layers like crust, oceans, atmospheres entirely. So in this picture, the whole planet is just the iron-rich core and the silicate mantle. Now, when this planet gets very close to its star, what's going to happen? If it's not ripped apart, it may deform, assuming a non-spherical shape. Now, getting this close to your star isn't a theoretical situation at all. Our model planet is KOI 1843.03, which whizzes around its star every 4.2 hours. And let's just take a second to appreciate that fact. A year for KOI 1843.03 is just 4.2 hours for us. That's crazy. This discovery paper where I grabbed this table also estimated the radius of the planet, but they didn't take into account the possibility of a non-spherical shape. KOI 1843.03 belongs to a class of planets called ultra-short period planets, or USP planets, which have orbital periods less than a day. In our paper, we analyzed a few other USP planets, but KOI 1843.03 has the shortest known orbital period to date, so I'll just focus on that one for this talk. So I mentioned before that it was possible for the planet to be pulled apart, and the Roche limit is the radial tipping point between the planet surviving and being destroyed. The equation I'm showing is a very classical result. It comes from a very old paper by Roche, but it assumes a constant density incompressible fluid body. We know that Earth isn't constant density or incompressible. So if we sort of assume that our exoplanets are somewhat like Earth, we're going to assume that they aren't constant density or incompressible either. We're going to need a more sophisticated approach if we want to simulate new planet shapes. We base our method on an older paper, which was actually interested in modeling stars in multiple systems. Stars like planets could be pulled into non-spherical shapes by the strong gravitational field of a companion. But the key differences between the methods are that first, we needed to break a particular symmetry in the system to add a stellar companion to our planet. And second, we needed to use a different equation of state, or a function that relates density and pressure. Rocky planets, just like the rocks in your backyard, have a non-zero density at zero pressure. The equation of state used by Hachizu, the author of that paper, for polytropic stars has zero density at zero pressure. For some of our minerals, then, we chose a simple modified polytrope equation of state, which is described in this paper, Seeger et al. 2007, which just adds a constant to the classical polytrope and creates the desired effect. Once we've chosen our minerals and their equation of state, the procedure goes like this. We start with some density for the whole planet. It doesn't need to be an accurate guess, so we could just pick constant density spheroid as an example. Then we compute the gravitational potential of the planet. It's important to remember that any extended body exerts a gravitational force on itself, and so has a gravitational potential. This step is by far the most computationally intensive part of the calculation, and we spent a lot of time figuring out how to do it in an optimized way. Next, we compute the enthalpy, which depends on stellar gravitational potential and centrifugal potential. Remember that the planet is spinning very quickly around its star. And by enforcing the right boundary conditions on the enthalpy, we can compute the consistent stellar properties, like the stellar mass. Enthalpy can be converted to density, and the cycle continues until it converges. Usually that takes a few iterations. So one of the coolest results of this modeling is that by assuming KOI 1843.03 is at the Roche limit, we can say something about its probable composition. We took a large sample of planets simulated with pure iron cores and silicate mantles and generated this plot from the ones that were just about to be pulled apart. The different colored lines here are different compositions. Yellow is more silicate and black is more iron. The vertical gray line here represents the range of parameters for KOI 1843.03. We can see that the measured transit radius and orbital period correspond to a composition of about 70% iron by mass, with some margin for error allowed for the error bars on the transit radius, which is why it's a vertical line and not a point. But when we change the core composition to iron sulfide, something interesting happens. Note that I have the same line here in the same place. Now, KOI 1843.03 is only compatible with the pure iron sulfide core if its radius measurement is a little off, and it would essentially be pure iron sulfide. We can't rule out that composition, but pure iron sulfide cores are a very extreme case anyway. The Earth's core, for example, is polluted by a light element, maybe sulfur, but it isn't pure iron sulfide. By testing the two end member cases of pure iron and pure iron sulfide, we gain some insight into what could happen at an intermediate composition, kind of like that of the Earth's core. In general, as we make the core of the planets more massive, keeping a constant radius, they become less distorted. Even then, KOI 1843.03 could be almost pure iron and still be distorted because it's in such an extreme environment. Aspect ratio on the y-axis here is defined as the long radius of the planet along the planet-star axis to the short radius of the planet towards the poles. If we measured Saturn the same way as an example, it has an aspect ratio of about 1.1, and I think that's the most extreme one in the solar system. So on the plot, I've drawn how a few of these planets might look if you slice them open down the middle. You can see the more distorted the planet, the more mantle it has. The mantle in this case is formed of silicates, and specifically perovskite and instatite, and that's more easily deformed than iron. After the previous sections, you might well be wondering how a planet like these USP planets could possibly form. And quite frankly, we don't know. There are several theories, but there's no definitive answer yet, so stay tuned, because we might figure it out. Finally, I'm going to present, very quickly, some work in progress modeling the transit shapes of distorted planets. You may already be familiar with the transit method of discovering planets. As a planet moves across the face of its star, some amount of light from the star is blocked, resulting in this characteristic shape in pink at the bottom. This is a transit light curve. The ingress and egress part of the transit, which I've highlighted here, are where the planet is only partially covering the stellar disk, and between those times, there wouldn't be any difference in flux if the star were perfectly uniform. It's not, and we'll get to that later, but for now you can assume that the transit will mostly look like this for a spherical planet. When the planet is no longer a sphere, though, something really cool happens. The projected area of the planet changes as it moves around the star, producing this characteristic W-shaped transit. I'm going to play that again a little slower, and I want you to watch the cross-section of the planet as it crosses the star. You can see it becomes a circular area at the midpoint and is elongated into an oval elsewhere. And that's what produces the bump in the middle of the transit, and as you'll soon see, this is exactly what happens when we simulate these transits. To measure the transit shape for a simulated transit, we're using a sophisticated ray tracing library and specialized hardware. But ray tracing is actually a pretty simple concept to understand. We simulate virtual photons, or rays, being emitted from a stellar disk, shown here on the right in orange, and we check to see if the rays are blocked by the planet. We sum up the photons that make it to some virtual detector, shown here in blue, and normalize, and we're done. We'll end with a normalized flux that's the sum of all the photon fluxes that make it to the detector or observer. So let's finally look at some simulated distorted transits. Again, these results are kind of preliminary, but they're still cool. As you can see, the characteristic W shape is present. They're not flat. The curves are colored by the CMF of the planet. Yellow in this case corresponds to the nearly pure iron case, and black corresponds to about 70% iron. Now, if I plot the difference between the distorted transit and a simple standard model, which is shaped like a trapezoid, we see that the maximum discrepancy is maybe 100 parts per million, which is the same as the transit depth itself, roughly. So you might need some very specialized equipment to actually measure this effect for a real planet, and that's something we're looking into. In addition to increased sensitivity, you might also need higher cadence or frequency of observations than we would get with Kepler or TESS. Again, this is something we're looking into. Now, real stars aren't uniform disks like what I used in the ray tracing and in the examples. Limb darkening, as the name suggests, darkens the limb or edge of the star compared to the center, which changes the intensity of the photons as a function of the angle around the star. Furthermore, if the planet doesn't cut the star exactly at the center, but instead crosses at some other height along the disk, we'll see a shallower transit since the limb is darker, and it'll also be shorter since the longest path across the star is the diameter. The effects of limb darkening and transit inclination both need to be explored before this paper is going to be ready for publication. So finally, let's just wrap up quickly. I hope I've successfully communicated these four big ideas to you, but you might still wonder how all this work fits together in the grand scheme of things. In one sense, I've shown you four projects that span two different topics, but consider the following. We don't understand completely how planets form. We've theorized barriers to planet formation that are obviously overcome. We see exoplanets, but we don't yet know how. Studying disks and planets together is how we'll hopefully fit the pieces together and gain a deeper understanding of our place in the universe. So I'm not saying at all that I have everything figured out, but I think studying planet formation from both sides, from disks and from formed planets, will be really important as this field moves further. So I have a few ideas for what I'll do next. Rate equation chemistry is what I use throughout my disk projects, but it only applies in certain limits. And when we relax those assumptions, things become very complex very quickly. Grain growth and fragmentation are important phenomena for planet formation, so it would be a great step forward to incorporate those into the grain drift model I presented earlier. Now, if everything goes well today, I'll be heading to the University of Chicago to work with Professor Fred Chesla, funded by a 51 Pegasi B postdoctoral fellowship from the Heising-Simons Foundation, to pursue projects like these that I'm listing, and more. So with that, I'll conclude, and thank you for your time.
If everyone can just unmute for a second.
Sorry.
That was a beautifully crafted talk, Ellen. Well, worthy of the beautiful science that you were showing. So the floor is now open for questions. Theron.
Ellen, great talk. Okay, so my question is about the work that is most preliminary, but I'm curious. I think it's a simple one. So you mentioned that the magnitude of the W shape for the when you have a distorted planet transiting, right, is roughly 100 parts per million. So that's for something about the size of the KOI 18 something. So what if you did that for, you know, giant planets or something? Is that magnitude larger enough that, you know, you expect that to be a lot easier to sort of explore that, just that phenomenon of a distorted planet moving in front, and using your technique to like understand that better?
Yeah, so I think that work has actually already been done, and I couldn't tell you the reference off the top of my head, but someone did do this for giant planets already, sort of seeing what their shape would be and what a transit of them would look like. Our results are pretty much consistent with theirs in that, like, there is a distortion, but obviously it's not as big. Also, I will point out that even though the distortion is about 100 parts per million, it's not necessarily at the center of the W shape. It actually might be in the ingress-egress part, which is interesting and not what I was expecting. So the depth that you're talking about at the sort of center of the W is actually probably different and less. So when I say we need sophisticated equipment, I'm not kidding.
Jennifer.
Hi, Ellen. That was a very interesting talk. I was also curious about the transit. Since you're dealing with these ultra short period transiting planets, are you in a regime that you're getting like weird other relativistic effects? Because there's like some weird stuff that happens to transit.
There is,
like,
yeah.
Lensing and yeah. Some other stuff.
yeah, I'm like sort of having flashbacks like the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect. I don't even know if that matters here, but that's one of the ones I remember from back in the day. We haven't thought about that at all, but that's a great question. we're sort of just simulating like literally just the blockage of light from the star right now. But it could be interesting to see if, you know, for such a small planet, if those effects matter. I honestly don't know. I would hope they wouldn't, because that'll probably mess up things like limb darkening is going to. But we'll see.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Question. Thank you. Very clear talk.
Are there any additional questions for Ellen? I don't see any other raised hands. Erwin, please. We can't hear you. Do you have a microphone you need to turn on?
I keep forgetting to unmute, I'm sorry. I may have misheard you, but I thought at one point you said something like you were considering 640 different kinds of molecules.
Yes.
But yet you seem to only discuss a couple.
Yes. So in the paper, we go into a little more detail about a couple of molecules. I think the more important result is just that there isn't a clear trend with the composition of each molecule. So we can't really say anything definitive about like, oh, well, if you include accretion, formaldehyde is enhanced. We can't say that. So I think the bigger issue is just seeing that there isn't really a trend. That being said, like technically we have all the data to see exactly what happens to all 644 species that we did simulate. But I'm not sure, you know, since there isn't a clear trend, it's difficult to tell a cohesive story unless you pick out a few that you're interested in.
Do you at all worry about the interactions between the molecules so that, for example, what the sensitivity would be of your results to leaving out some of the molecules?
I mean, when you say worry,
sorry?
I try not to worry, but certainly it is possible if we've left out some chemistry that actually is important, even though we try to be as comprehensive as we can with this particular network. It could be the case that we're missing something important, and then all of this could be wrong, I guess. But we try not to worry about that too much. People much smarter than me put together this network, and so we sort of just use it and trust that it's probably as comprehensive as it's possible to be right now.
I was just thinking of the sensitivity, so that you could see, for example, if you had omitted some, what effects they might have.
I mean, it's kind of hard to say. It would depend on the kind of the reaction. And even then, there are a lot of numerical issues that came up with that project, including an interesting one where the order of the chemical reactions as they were entered into the network actually mattered for some reason, which was horrifying until I figured out why that happened. So certainly it is possible, even with these small seemingly insignificant tweaks to get slightly different results. And yeah, we would just need to test it on a different chemical network or remove an important chemical reaction and see how things changed.
Thank you.
Any last question? Gary, please.
Oh, Ellen, it was a beautiful talk. I very much enjoyed it. I may have missed it because I got called away for 2 minutes, but I'm wondering if you could say briefly the effect of cosmic rays on the results. I know you mentioned it briefly, but obviously these disks are forming planets all over the galaxy and in different cosmic ray environments, presumably. So I'm just wondering if you could summarize in a few sentences the extreme differences you see as a function of cosmic ray rates.
Yeah, so basically, what we think is happening with the cosmic rays is essentially a packet that starts further out in the disk is going to be exposed to more cosmic rays than when it gets to the interior of the disk because the surface density there is higher. So what we did is we actually were able to track back, sort of back through time, what was causing some species to be enhanced. And all of them seemed to trace back to an initial cosmic ray ionization. And then the subsequent chain of reactions as things warmed up and the packet moved inward. And that's why I mentioned the cosmic rays. Basically, the fact that a packet is exposed to cosmic rays at the beginning of its lifetime and then warms up towards the end really enables some different chemistry than what we would have seen without the cosmic rays. We also did test a model with higher cosmic rays. We didn't talk about it too much in the paper. We also took out cosmic rays to see what would happen. And I think we just confirmed that basically cosmic rays are driving a lot of this chemistry.
Thank you.
So that brings us just a little bit past the hour. So it's a perfect timing. I don't see any additional hands raised. So what will happen next is that, well, first of all, if you want to unmute again and again, congratulate Ellen on this beautiful presentation. then maybe especially for Ellen's friends and family that are calling in, what will happen next is that we'll go into a private defense with the committee. If everything goes well, there will then be a little Zoom celebration later in the afternoon. So those of you who are at the CFA, look for that CFA wide email. For those of you who are not at CFA, I'm counting on that Ellen will indeed forward you the information. So if she doesn't, bug her about that, and that will happen sort of in the early afternoon. But yeah, without further ado, fantastic work, Ellen, and the committee. I think committee will reconvene in I think about 6 minutes or so. And if you can't find the link, email me and I'll send it to you. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for coming, everyone.